because that has never meant anything good for the people in the rest of the world. But the fact that there is maybe another challenger being lifted up and presented to Washington, that's, I think, a healthy development.
But the question now is what it will take for the European U.S. allies to turn their ideas into action and seek independence from Washington.
Venezuela's main opposition parties have announced an end to 3 years of boycotting elections. The country's opposition alliance, the so-called Democratic Unity Roundtable, which is led by the U.S.-sponsored opposition figure Juan Guaido, announced on Tuesday that it would participate in the regional and municipal elections scheduled for November 21. President Nicolas Maduro has praised the move as worthy of applause for returning to democracy. The opposition, however, said its participation would not mean that it believed the elections would be free or fair. The alliance boycotted the 2018 presidential vote, which Maduro won, and the 2020 legislative elections, in which the opposition lost control of Congress. In both cases, it dismissed the elections as fraudulent. Its decision to end the boycott comes as government and opposition representatives are involved in talks, mediated by Norway and hosted by Mexico. The talks, which began last month, are aimed at resolving the political crisis that plagued the Latin American country after Guaido unilaterally declared himself interim president in January 2019. Back in 2019, Guaido proclaimed himself the interim president of Venezuela. Back then, the administration of former President Donald Trump, along with several European countries and a number of right-wing Latin American leaders, recognized Guaido as Venezuela's interim president. The U.S. confiscated Venezuelan state assets in America in a bid to support Guaido.
They were doing things that really were undermining the autonomy and the sovereignty of Venezuela to have its own free and fair elections, and were committing acts which they had no right under any sort of international law to do. And so it just is a matter of time before the failure of all these events catches up to the United States and the Venezuelan opposition who it was working with.
The U.S. move was seen as an attempt to topple the legitimate government of Venezuela. That was not the first time the U.S. pushed for regime change in Venezuela. Back in 2002, during the presidency of George W. Bush, a coup was orchestrated against Venezuela's former president Hugo Chavez. The plot failed due to overwhelming popular support and mobilization against the coup. Washington has a long list of military interventions and coups in different Latin American countries. Venezuela is now one of the few countries in that region which is led by a left-wing anti-imperialist government. The U.S. push to oust Maduro's government is reminiscent of U.S. colonial moves in Latin America during the 20th century. The Food Assistance Agency of the UN has estimated that one out of every three Venezuelans is struggling to consume enough daily calories.
The United States has fully withdrawn its forces from Afghanistan to officially end 20 years of occupation. The invasion will be remembered for its colossal failures, unfulfilled promises, and a frantic final exit that cost the lives of scores of Afghan civilians and 13 U.S. military personnel. The final U.S. evacuation flight left Kabul Airport late on Monday. U.S. military officials say hundreds of Americans who have been left on Afghan soil will be transported out of the country in the coming days. A Taliban spokesman says the defeat of the United States in Afghanistan was a lesson for the invaders.
The withdrawal of foreign forces is a big achievement for the Afghans and their independence. It is the day of good lesson for the aggressors that they shouldn't have invaded Afghanistan.
More than 122,000 people have reportedly been evacuated from Kabul since August the 14th, the day before the Taliban took control of the country. U.S. President Joe Biden has come under immense criticism of his handling of the withdrawal. Nearly 90 retired U.S. generals and admirals have called for Pentagon Chief Lloyd Austin and Joint Chiefs Chairman General Mark Milley to resign for their roles surrounding the chaotic pullout. The retired flag officers proposed what they felt should have happened in the withdrawal, including not rushing the pullout and not abandoning the Bagram airbase and American weapons and military equipment in the hands of the Taliban.
The war in Afghanistan is now over. I'm the fourth president who has faced the issue of whether and when to end this war. When I was running for president, I made a commitment to the American people that I would end this war. Today, I've honored that commitment. It was time to be honest with the American people again.
Well, I don't believe the U.S. government has learned a lesson. The U.S. media certainly hasn't learned a lesson. Statements we've seen from Biden, for instance, have been that we've accomplished our goals in Afghanistan, which I think is furthest from the truth.
The U.S. invaded Afghanistan in 2001 following the 9/11 attacks under the pretext of so-called war on terror. According to estimates, America's longest war took the lives of nearly 2,500 U.S. troops and an estimated 240,000 Afghans, and cost around $2 trillion U.S. dollars. Thousands of Afghan civilians were also maimed during the years. The estimated interest costs of the war are expected to top $6.5 trillion by 2050.
I think the U.S. went in there 20 years ago, removed the Taliban, and now the Taliban is back, perhaps stronger than ever. It seems like it's an utter defeat for the United States.
The war has left Afghanistan in ruins and devastated the country's infrastructure. Just as Saigon marked the humiliating defeat of U.S. geostrategic ambitions in Indochina after 10 years of war and conflict in Vietnam, many analysts now believe Kabul marks the same humiliating defeat in Central Asia.
You know, after the Vietnam War, there was something they called the Vietnam Syndrome. The American people didn't want to go into that kind of war ever again. And I believe we're seeing the beginning of an Afghan syndrome. The American people think it was a mistake, don't want to see it again. The trillions of dollars that went into Afghanistan could have been used to help the Afghani people or for the American people.
The botched military occupation is likely to trigger a refugee crisis in the Middle East and beyond. When it comes to Afghanistan and the wider region, Washington and its allies have proved after two decades that they have nothing to offer but misery and despair. U.S. officials believed that a U.S.-trained, funded, and equipped Afghan army could hold the line against the poorly trained, funded, and equipped Taliban insurgency. But after a 20-year presence in Afghanistan, they still had little or no understanding of Afghan society and the power of Taliban militants.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به تخت اعلی.
In the path of the Imam.
Dear listeners, we're going to continue our discussion of Imam Khomeini's views on different issues. In today's program, you'll be listening to his advice on the authorities and students of seminaries. Please stay with us. Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, had explicated his views on seminaries and presented necessary warnings on the issue during his lifetime. However, this issue is the most important message to the seminaries and to religious scholars or ulama in the waning months of the Imam's life. In his message, the Imam called the ulama or religious scholars as the carriers and trustees of revelation, which they should strive to guide the people through the content of revelation and what has been bequeathed to us from the Prophet of Islam and his infallible progeny, blessings of God upon them. He writes in his message, "There is no doubt that the seminaries and the committed ulama throughout the history of Islam and Shi'ism have been the most important bastion of Islam against assaults and deviations. The great religious scholars or ulama of Islam have tried through their lifetimes to promote the issues of divine haram or forbidden laws and halal or permitted laws without modification. Had there not been the dear jurisprudence, it was not clear what sciences would have been sold to the masses in the name of sciences of the Quran, Islam, and Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them. The collection and preservation of the sciences of the Holy Quran and Islam and the works and hadith of the great prophet and the practices and behavior of the infallible imams, peace be upon them, and the registration, compilation, and explication of them under the conditions that there were very little facilities and the rulers and oppressors had employed all their facilities to destroy the works of prophethood was not an easy job. Yet, thank God, today we can see the result of those efforts in the works and books such as Kutub-e Arba'eh, the four main books of Shia seminaries, and other books of the previous and future generations in the fields of jurisprudence, philosophy, mathematics, astronomy, principles of jurisprudence, hadith, history of Islam, exegesis of the Holy Quran, literature, Irfan or Gnosticism, lexicon, and all various fields of sciences. If we do not call this much effort as jihad in the way of God, then what shall we call it?" Imam Khomeini continues in his message for ulama and the seminaries. "As for the scientific services of seminaries, there is too much to say to the extent that it goes beyond the scope of what can be mentioned here. Thank God the seminaries are rich and innovative from the viewpoint of sources and methods of discussion and ijtihad or independent reasoning on the basis of the Holy Quran and Hadith. I do not think that there can be found a more proper way for deep and comprehensive examination of Islamic sciences than the methods of the preceding ulama. Over 1,000 years of history of research and erudition of true ulama or religious scholars of Islam bears testimony to this claim. This has nurtured the sapling of Islam to flourish. For hundreds of years, the clergy of Islam have been the support of the deprived. The downtrodden have always been satiated by the pure kosar of the teachings of great jurisprudence. Apart from their scientific and cultural struggles, which are superior to the bloods of martyrs in some aspects, in every age, they have suffered hardships and bitterness in defense of their religion and patriotic sanctities. And while suffering captivity, exile, prison, imprisonment, harassment, and taunts, they have offered precious martyrs to the divine court. The martyrs of the clergy are not restricted to the martyrs of struggles and the war in Iran. Certainly, the number of anonymous martyrs of seminaries and the clergy who have lost their lives in the path of spreading the divine teachings and divine laws in the hands of mercenaries is very large. In every divine and popular uprising and revolution, the ulama or religious scholars of Islam have been the first who have been martyred. Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, continued by saying, "This does not mean that we defend all clergymen, and the dependent and sanctimonious clergy were not and are not small in number. There are people in seminaries who are active against pure Muhammadian Islam. Today some people, through sanctimonious posture, are cutting the roots of religion, revolution, and the system in a way as if they had no other duty. The danger of this backwardness and regression is certainly not small. Dear students, should not neglect these colorful snakes for a single moment. These are the promoters of American Islam and the enemies of God's messengers." The late Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, points to two key methods that are used by enemies in seminaries. The Imam said, "Once the global arrogance was disappointed at complete destruction of the clergy and seminaries, it chose two ways to strike. One was intimidation and coercion, and the other way was deception and infiltration in the contemporary decades. When the weapon of intimidation and threatening was useless, the way of infiltration was strengthened. The first and most important move was the insinuation of the slogan of separation of religion from politics, which has unfortunately worked to some extent in seminaries and among the clergy so that interference in politics is considered as inferior to the status of the jurisprudent, and entering the arena of politics will cause the accusation of dependence on foreigners. For sure, the struggling clergy have been suffering more from infiltration. Do not think that the accusation of dependence and calumny of irreligiousness have been applied against the clergy only by foreigners. This is not so. The blows of unaware and dependent, aware clergy have been much stronger than those of the foreigners." Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, also addressed the clergy in his testimony. The Imam said, "I recommend to the seminaries, as I have repeatedly said, that in this era that the opponents of Islam and the Islamic Republic have attempted to topple Islam and try in every way to achieve this satanic goal, one of the important ways to this unholy and dangerous end is to infiltrate deviated and wicked persons in seminaries, whose great short-term danger is to scandalize the seminaries with indecent acts and deviated ethics and methods. And the very danger in long term is to attain high positions by one or a few charlatans who ensconce themselves among the masses and strata of pure-hearted people and make them love them, and then deal a fatal blow to the Islamic seminaries and Dear Islam and their country at the right moment. Dear listeners, in our next program, we shall continue our discussions today. Until then, goodbye and God bless.
For decades, US dollars have been dominating global trade. And for years, the United States has been flexing its financial muscle through its dollars. The country's unilateral sanctions, for example, could never be imaginable without the unique position the greenback has held in international trade since World War II. Yet this dominance by no means is to be permanent. In fact, there are many factors now at play challenging the almighty dollar. During World War II, the US served as the Allies' main provider of weapons, supplies, and other goods. Collecting much of its payment in gold by the end of the war, the US owned the vast majority of the world's gold. So after the war, countries linked their currencies to the dollar, which was linked to gold, and instead of gold reserves, they accumulated reserves of US dollars. Needing a place to store their dollars, they began buying U.S. Treasury securities, considered to be a safe store of money. The demand for Treasury securities, coupled with the deficit spending needed to finance the Vietnam War and the Great Society domestic programs launched by President Lyndon B. Johnson, caused the U.S. to flood the market with paper money. With growing concerns over the stability of the dollar, countries began to convert dollar reserves into gold. The demand for gold was such that President Richard Nixon was forced to intervene and de-link the dollar from gold, which led to the floating exchange rates that exist today. Although the US dollar has remained the world's reserve currency for decades, issues such as large deficit spending, trillions of dollars in debt, and the unbridled printing of US dollars are shaking its status. In early May, billionaire Stanley Druckenmiller sounded a warning that the dollar could cease to be the prominent global reserve currency within 15 years. His warning comes against the backdrop of a long-standing retreat from the dollar as the world has moved gradually towards a multiple reserve currency system. The IMF's latest survey shows that shares of US dollar reserves held by central banks fell to 59% during the fourth quarter of 2020, its lowest level in 25 years. The U.S. accounted for the majority of the industrial production of the non-Soviet world after the Second World War, so it made sense that the dollar was the principal unit in which exporters and importers invoiced and settled their trade, in which international loans were extended, and in which central banks held their reserves. But today, with the U.S. accounting for less than a quarter of global gross domestic product, it makes less sense. The latest IMF numbers indicate countries that trade with and borrow from the euro area increasingly seek to hold euro reserves. That process is now happening with China and the renminbi. Inside the United States, there are mounting fears that the Federal Reserve's mismanagement, coupled with Joe Biden's careless fiscal policy and inflation, could undermine the dollar. Former Treasury Secretary Larry Summers has recently said, "The Biden administration is pursuing the least responsible fiscal macroeconomic policy we've had for the last 40 years, adding, "We're seeing an episode that I think differs both quantitatively and qualitatively from anything since Paul Volcker's days at the Fed, and it stands to reason that that would lead to significant changes in expectations." In other words, the anti-inflationary credibility won by the Fed over the past 40 years may now be in question, causing foreign investors to worry that the U.S. will inflate away the value of their treasury holdings. Against such a backdrop, the world is looking for other viable alternatives. For example, the European Union is trying to create a recovery fund financed by commonly used EU debt. Although the move is yet tentative, it suggests that the euro, currently making up to 20% of global reserves, could play an increasing role. In the case of the renminbi, Beijing is committed to challenging the dollar and has actively encouraged the use of the renminbi in bilateral trade transactions. The Belt and Road Initiative provides new financing opportunities for the digital renminbi, currently under development. And Beijing has the advantage that China has recovered more strongly than the other big economies from the COVID-19 setback. Foreign capital has been flooding in too, as China has progressively opened up its financial markets. The wild card here relates to digital currencies. Geeta Gopinath, IMF chief economist, believes that technology has plenty to offer in providing cheaper and faster cross-border payments and improving financial inclusion.
Many institutional investors are trying to expose to the cryptocurrency. They are holding Bitcoin as an alternative asset to hedge the risk of global monetary easing. And also some retail investors, they just discovered new ways to hold crypto assets because PayPal just opened their cryptocurrency business services to their retail users in U.S. market. So from the demand side, there's a huge surge.
Finally, what might undermine the dominance of the U.S. dollar is the weaponization of the dollar, or the U.S. government's exploitation of the currency's global dominance to extend the extraterritorial reach of U.S. law and policy. The most outstanding example is the Trump administration's enforcement of economic sanctions against Iran in an attempt to shut the country out of the international banking system, and in particular, SWIFT.
I think the U.S. has weaponized American dollar together with the international payment system known as the SWIFT system. Therefore, any company in the world, if it is doing business using U.S. dollars, actually, it is under the supervision of the American authority.
Faced almost with the same sanctions, Russia shifted its reserves out of the dollars in 2018 and is selling its oil in non-dollar currencies. Likewise, Europe or China may succeed in developing alternative payment mechanisms that would allow countries such as Iran to sell its oil. That might in turn undermine the dollar's role in the long run.
It's just the very fact that the Americans do use their extraterritorial power over the dollar in lots and lots of different ways does make other countries now more likely to look at non-dollar currencies to hold their reserves. It also pushes countries into gold, for example. We've seen that with the Russians.
If the pace of financial sanctions continues to grow over the next decade, it might increase the attractiveness of cross-border payment systems based on the euro, renminbi, or other alternatives. With the dollar facing all these challenges, Washington is expected to have a hard time maintaining its current hegemony in the years to come.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz, every day from 15:20 to 16:20 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 19:20 to 20:20 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5 and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/EN. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box 19395-6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Blood gained victory over the sword on the day of Ashura because of Zainab. April 21st, 2010. Zainab al-Kubra is a prominent role model in history and shows the significance of a woman's presence in one of the most important events in human history. Blood gained a victory over the sword on the day of Ashura, and Zainab al-Kubra was the cause of that victory. This was because the forces of righteousness were apparently defeated in a military fight in Karbala, but Zainab al-Kubra's behavior was the factor that turned this apparent defeat into a permanent and decisive victory. That victory was due to the role she played after the day of Ashura. But Zainab al-Kubra is a recent example and does not belong to ancient times. The story of her life is a tangible event. She played a brilliant role making the enemies who had apparently won the battle and slain all their opponents feel humiliated in their own base. She branded them with permanent disgrace and turned their victory into a defeat. Today, the name of Hussein ibn Ali shines like the sun.
Ana mazlum Hussein, ana mazlum Hussein, ana mazlum. أنا لاتشان.
Imam Hussein, peace be upon him, made the army of reason overcome the army of ignorance.
أنا لاتشان. أنا لات.
Today the name of Hussein ibn Ali shines like the sun. February 17, 2010. On the day of Karbala, Hussein ibn Ali and his companions were martyred in an abandoned desert where there was not any friend and where there were many enemies. On that day, his family members were taken captive, and that was over. Today, this event, which should normally have been destroyed and consigned to oblivion after 10, 15 days, is still prominent. Even after the passage of many centuries, the name of Hussein ibn Ali is shining like the sun, and it is enlightening hearts and offering guidance not only among millions of Shias and other Muslims in different Islamic countries, but also among non-Muslims.
Another wide-scale operation was launched by the Yemeni army against the oil giant Aramco in several areas in Saudi Arabia. The spokesman of the Yemeni army said Yemen's air force has successfully targeted Aramco's oil facilities in Ras Tanura in Dammam with 8 drones of Samathri type and a ballistic missile.
Our forces have targeted Aramco oil facilities in Ras Tanura in the Dammam region, eastern Saudi Arabia, with 8 Samad 3 drones and a Zulfiqar ballistic missile.
Saria also added that Aramco's facilities in Jeddah, Jazan, and Najran were also successfully hit by 5 ballistic missiles and 2 drones of Samathri type. He then warned Riyadh against further attacks until the war on Yemen is stopped. Earlier, Saudi officials said they had intercepted ballistic missiles targeting eastern province as well as the cities of Najran and Jazan in the south. The attacks came in response to the years-long Saudi aggression against Yemen.
Yemen's army has no way but to intensify its attacks against Saudi Arabia amid the kingdom's aggression against the impoverished nation. Saudi Arabia uses all capabilities, targeting civilian areas in Yemen, destroying the country's infrastructures. The latest attacks by the Yemeni army serve as a tit-for-tat operation.
Saudi Arabia launched a deadly war against Yemen in March 2015, killing tens of thousands of civilians, most of them women and children, and displacing millions more.
People here hailed the Yemeni army for its retaliatory attacks on Saudi Arabia. They say Saudi Arabia will remain a legitimate target for them as long as it continues its aggression against the impoverished nation. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Across the world, the Afghan crisis continues to be a major talking point. It's no different here in the EU's de facto capital, Brussels. Members of the public have been sharing their views with Press TV.
I think they should leave the country and try for themselves to come out of it.
We should not intervene sometimes in proposing democracy or the sorts of political situations where they're not in, when the country is not ready.
Especially the United States did in this country. It make it worse, I think.
Now they are taking all of the materials, but I think as a global community, we should interfere, but to stop that.
Power and interference always go together.
Anti-war campaigners are furious at remarks made by EU Foreign Policy Chief Joseph Borrell last Thursday. He said Afghanistan proves the need for an expanded EU military force, more commonly referred to as the EU Army.
We have to step up our integrated approach, combining military, civilian, development and diplomatic efforts.
We have been speaking to citizens about Afghans who are desperate to seek asylum. EU leaders, they don't want more refugees. Do you think we should take more refugees in?
Yes, he needs to take more refugees because these people is in bad situation in their country.
Belgian people or European people say that we don't have any enough place, but I think we have.
We must take refugees because all the people are on the same world. We are the same world.
They need to offer that help, and I believe that they need to offer a place to stay because they have nowhere else to stay.
The policy of occupying nations against their will certainly didn't go well in Afghanistan. Top EU officials and also prime ministers in the 27-country bloc are saying lessons must be learned. A good start, critics argue, would be for the EU to stop responding how high when Washington shouts, jump. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Among the seven Iranian COVID vaccines, Covfars is making a name for itself. Developed by Razi Serum and Vaccine Research Institute, the recombinant vaccine started the third human trial phase on Sunday.
In this phase, we are going to have 40,000 people in two groups, one receiving Sinopharm and the other Razi Covfars. We are going to compare the number of people who are going to get sick in each group, and by comparing with each other, what we are hoping to show is that the efficacy of our vaccine is at least the same as the Sinopharm.
Iran has so far vaccinated roughly 10% of its population. This as the resurgence of the coronavirus in more lethal forms, like the Delta variant, has been killing an average of around 500 Iranians every day in the past month. As the government is scrambling to import more vaccines, Covfars authorities say they're working to get an emergency use license to help speed up the inoculation program.
Given the restrictions imposed by U.S. sanctions on the way of vaccine imports to Iran, we need to boost our domestic production of COVID vaccines. So we are expecting that Covfars will get the emergency use license halfway through the third trial stage.
Covfars is administered in three doses, two intramuscular shots 21 days apart, and one intranasal shot 1 month after the second dose. Covfars says if all goes based on the plan, the vaccine will hit the market in 6 months.
As the coronavirus keeps transforming into wilder variants, Covfars developers say they've already launched their production line to speed up the vaccination process. The biotech firm says as soon as it gets the emergency use license, it will kick off mass production with a capacity of 3 million doses per month. Yusuf Jalali, Alborz Province.
Taliban have deployed more troops and military hardware to the northeastern Panjshir Valley to take the last remaining territory in Afghanistan from the National Resistance Front, headed by Ahmed Massoud, the son of Afghanistan's national hero, Ahmad Shah Massoud. Massoud has called for a negotiated settlement with the Taliban, but has said his forces will resist if the narrow and mountainous valley is attacked. Meanwhile, some top political leaders urge both sides to set aside differences and resume a meaningful negotiation in a bid to avoid dangerous scenarios, mainly the loss of civilian lives in Panjshir, as well as a spread of armed resistance across the rest of provinces.
The only way of the ongoing situation in Panjshir is to simultaneously resume meaningful negotiations and continue resistance against any totalitarian policy to pave the way for establishment of an inclusive government.
This is while the expansion of war has forced hundreds of local villagers to flee their houses. They call on the international community and especially the UN to convince both sides to resume negotiations.
The war has forced us to flee our village and come to Kabul. I have 5 children. We have nowhere to go but city parks. We want peace. Our children should take up their education in a calm atmosphere. So I want Massoud and Taliban to stop their war machines.
The possible fall of Panjshir Valley into the hands of Taliban will bring the entire country under the rule of Taliban for the first time, as they couldn't capture Panjshir Valley during their first rule in Afghanistan before their collapse in 2001.
The war on Panjshir has turned into a big headache for the Taliban. Moreover, the group's leaders have so far failed to reach an agreement on the formation of the new government in Kabul. The Taliban have postponed the move again, saying they need more time for final consultations among the group's top leaders. Syed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
A high-level Lebanese ministerial and security delegation has arrived in Damascus. Deputy Prime Minister of the Lebanese caretaker government, Zain Akkar, who holds several other positions, headed the delegation, which included the ministers of energy and finance, as well as head of the General Directorate of General Security. They were welcomed by Syria's foreign minister at the Jdeidet Yabus crossing. The delegation held talks with several Syrian officials at once at the foreign ministry, namely the Syrian ministers of foreign affairs, finance, and oil. Talks focused on economic cooperation and Lebanon's need of Syria's help in transferring gas for generating electricity.
The two sides discussed the difficult circumstances they are living in, especially the electricity and gas sectors. The Lebanese side asked Syria to help Lebanon in transferring Egyptian gas and Jordanian electricity through Syrian territories. The Syrian side welcomed our request and expressed Syria's readiness to assist.
Both sides agreed to follow up the technical aspects and details of implementation through a joint technical team. Observers believe such a visit was only possible due to the U.S. backing of a plan that ensures Lebanon obtains gas.
I think Lebanon got a green light from the U.S. for such a visit. The Syrian government conveyed a message to the Lebanese side that it has accepted their request. I think the matter now is in the hands of Lebanon to get a regional and international approval for Syria's participation in pumping gas to Lebanon, as there are U.S. and EU economic sanctions on Syria.
Lebanon is seeking to revive a 2009 deal which stipulated that Egypt transfers millions of cubic meters of gas annually to Syria through Jordan, while Syria pumps the same amount to Lebanon. This is Lebanese officials' most significant visit to Syria since the start of the crisis in 2011. Lebanon, which remained relatively neutral towards Syria for so long, seems to have no other option now in light of its economic slowdown but to fully reactivate its cooperation and relations with Syria in hopes of some economic relief. Hamad Ali, Damascus.
Streets remain deserted and business establishments closed in all major towns and the capital city of Indian-administered Kashmir for the second day after the death of the region's veteran separatist leader, Syed Ali Gilani. Indian forces continued a strong presence to prevent anti-government protests and enforce a strict lockdown. The authorities had also imposed near-total communication blockade across Kashmir as a precautionary measure to maintain law and order. On Friday, additional deployments were made to prevent people from holding anti-government protests after the Friday prayers.
Gilani, the most powerful separatist leader in Kashmir who spent many years in different jails, died on Wednesday evening at his Srinagar residence, where he had remained incarcerated for the past decade.
As the news of his death spread far and wide, authorities swung into action and sealed the roads leading to Gilani's Haidarpura residence. Security was beefed up across the region, barricades erected, and key roads sealed, calling and internet services were shut. According to his family members, the former lawmaker, who after quitting electoral politics in late 1980s had for years spearheaded the separatist movement in Kashmir, had desired to be buried in Srinagar's historic martyrs' graveyard. But the family members alleged that police forcibly took away his body and in a quiet funeral buried him in a graveyard near his residence.
He passed away late evening. We live in his neighborhood. We were neither allowed to visit his residence to pay him last respect, not allowed to participate in his funeral sitting COVID. This is very unfortunate. It will hurt us forever. We wanted to participate in the funeral procession of our leader, but we were not allowed by forces. He was hurriedly buried, and no one was allowed to say him the final goodbye. At least we should have been allowed to offer funeral prayers.
Known for his pro-Pakistan stance, Gilani led several anti-India protests and marches. He became a household name during 2008 and 2010 public uprising in Kashmir. A staunch advocate of Kashmir's right to self-determination, Gilani had stepped down as Hurriyat Conference chairman after he suffered with ailing health. He was conferred Pakistan's highest civilian honor in 2020. His death has been widely condoled, with Pakistan's Premier Imran Khan describing him as, quote, Mujahid-e-Kashmir. Meanwhile, police spokesman has said that there has been no incident of violence or protest in Kashmir after Gilani's death. Kashmir has been a bone of contention between India and Pakistan. Both the nations claim the region in full, but rule it in parts. Sidri Safib, Indian-administered Kashmir.
A new major victory has been achieved by the Yemeni army against the Saudi-backed forces in Yemen's oil-rich province of Marib. Yemen's armed forces have recaptured the strategic Rahba district and the southern Marib, meaning that all supply routes linking Al-Bayda and Marib will be cut off from the Saudi-backed forces.
Cutting off the supplies in Al-Rahba would weaken the enemy forces. There is also synchronization in the movement of our forces in the rest of the northern and southern fronts towards the city of Marib, and this constitutes a siege on the city from all sides. All supplies have been cut off from the Saudi-led forces, and they can no longer carry out any military action. Light weapons will be more effective, and the army is now able to advance more towards Harib and Al-Juba.
The Yemeni army has also managed to take control of other military sites overlooking the city of Marib from the western and northern sides, which would help the armed forces continue advancing towards the Harib and Al-Juba areas.
The Yemeni army managed to liberate the entire district of Al-Rahba and cut off the supply routes from Al-Bayda. With that, the liberation of Al-Juba and Habri area became easier for the Yemeni army. There is an insistence by the Yemeni army to liberate the city of Marib, especially after the Saudi-led coalition's rejection of Ansar Allah's recent initiative to stop military operations there.
For months now, the Yemeni army has been intensifying its military operations aimed at liberating the strategic Marib province from the Saudi-backed forces, including terrorist groups. Marib has strategic importance as an oil-rich province. It is the last stronghold of Saudi Arabia in northern Yemen.
Yemenis believe that their army will eventually liberate Marib from all foreign powers, including the Saudi-backed forces. They say now Riyadh has to bear the consequences of its disregard for Ansarullah's recent initiative to end the ongoing crisis in Yemen. Abdul Latif Al-Washari, Sana'a.
Overnight security clampdown and communications blackout occurred in Indian-administered Kashmir after the region's iconic leader, Syed Ali Shah Gilani, died. The mosques in the region announced the demise. However, Gilani's followers were not able to participate in his funeral prayers.
Every home in Kashmir is mourning this loss. Authorities do not allow anyone to move out of homes. They should not have done this. It was our right to participate in his funeral prayers. After all, India claims to be a democracy. Can't we even mourn?
Officials say people's participation could have resulted in massive law and order problems.
Restrictions were imposed to keep law and order in place. No untoward incident occurred anywhere during the last 24 hours, and the situation has been peaceful.
Kashmir has witnessed a record number of internet blackouts in the world and is the world's largest militarized zone. Analysts say people of Kashmir have been forced into this silence since India stripped Kashmir of its autonomous status in August 2019.
The silence which was imposed upon the people is a human rights violation. They could not go to attend the funeral of their one of the veteran tallest leaders of Jammu and Kashmir, who has all along his life said and advocated about the right to self-determination.
The Organization of Islamic Cooperation has condemned the Indian government's denial of right to choose burial rituals inside of the Saeed Ali Shah Gilani. Observers say people of Kashmir have been forced into a controlled kind of a life where every rule is not set by their choice, but by the force of the governing authorities.
Saeed Ali Gilani was one of the tallest leaders of the resistance movement of Jammu and Kashmir and was advocating for right to self-determination. He deserved a respectful funeral, but the government did not allow the funeral to happen other than his family members. International covenants and international law says that every person who dies is to be handed over to his family for a choicest burial and a choicest funeral.
People of Kashmir say since the Hindu nationalist Bharatiya Janata Party took a unanimous decision on Kashmir's special status in August 2019, a lot has changed without their consent. They say the silence of international community on the plight of Kashmiri people has added to their miseries, and with each passing day, living in the controlled land is getting difficult for them. And sooner or later, Kashmiri people are going to be the world's new asylum seekers. Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
The house was recently bombed by a U.S. drone strike. Sharpness have even damaged the door of the house. 10 members of a single family, including 6 children, lost their lives in the recent U.S. drone strike. As the relatives of the victims say, the owner of the house, which was targeted by the attack, was an engineer with no ties to any terrorist group. Imal Ahmadi is the brother of the owner of the house. He explains how the U.S. airstrike claimed the lives of his beloved ones in a moment.
I had left the house almost 10 minutes before that U.S. brutal attack. I quickly got back after I received a call from a relative. I saw the dead bodies of my brother, his sons and daughters all over the yard.
Blaming the U.S. for launching blind attacks on civilian areas, Imal is also angry on international journalists and the United Nations for what he says turning a blind eye on their misery.
A number of local and international journalists have so far interviewed us, but no one, including the United Nations, has heard our voice. Everybody follows his or her own agenda with paying no attention to our demand. We want justice, and the UN is responsible.
It was August 30 when the U.S. airstrike hit this vehicle inside a house located in northeastern Kabul. Later, Pentagon said that they have successfully eliminated a vehicle packed with explosives in the city of Kabul. However, Taliban urgently condemned the attack, calling it an inhuman assault on civilians. Sayed Amin Alami, Kabul.
Turkey has proposed to the European Union